This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 5, Episode 9 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
I'm John.
And we are here today for part two in our series on LeVar Burton, looking at his Emmy-nominated work, where we'll be looking at the first work that he did, well, overall, and the first work that he did that was nominated for an Emmy, Roots.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Roots was a television miniseries that came out in 1977. It was based on a book by Alex Haley, who traced his ancestry, supposedly, back to a guy named Kunta Kinte, who was a African who was brought over in like 1767 to America by slave traders, where he became a slave. And it follows his descendants, allegedly follows his descendants through their family history up until, well, I guess just after the Civil War and when they were liberated and stuff. It was a very, very big deal when it came out, and is still considered to be very, very good. When the WGA released their list of the 101 best-written television shows of all time, they ranked Roots at number 62. And they said something which I found to be very interesting about kind of its place in history, which I thought I would read, because I think it does a good job of sort of placing it in the proper historical context. They said, Roots, from executive producer David L. Wolper, was more than a miniseries. It was a spectacular and unprecedented example of television's power as a storytelling medium, one that could simultaneously direct the national conversation and prod its conscience. Adapting Alex Haley's epic autobiographical look at his ancestry into script form fell to William Blinn, M. Charles Cohen, James Lee, and Ernest Kenoy. If the historical accuracy of the story was challenged in some circles, the 12-hour miniseries, aired in 90-minute installments over 8 consecutive nights, that doesn't add up, but that's okay, to huge ratings, had a deeply visceral impact on a nation confronting a part of its history that broadcast television had never shown on such a grand scale. Some 100 million viewers tuned into the final chapter. That last episode is still the third highest-rated television program in history, and I think always will be. And LeVar Burton was in the first 4 of those hours, and for those 4 parts, I guess actually just part 1, he was nominated for an Emmy for Best Lead Actor. So yeah, the series aired on like 8 consecutive nights in 1977. It was nominated for 37 Emmys. It won 9 of them, including Best Miniseries. Burton was nominated for Lead Actor, along with 3 other actors from the same show. It's the first time in history that an entire acting category at the Emmys was filled up by people all from the same show. And he lost to Louis Gossett Jr., which, I mean, you know, if you're going to lose to someone, I guess that's a good
person. It's not bad company to be in.
Yeah. And, yeah, it was his very first role. So what are your thoughts on Roots on the whole? John?
I completely get why it is such a landmark TV event. I really do. You know, it came out in 77, so I didn't exactly watch it, you know, live. So years later, to put it in perspective, I didn't even know LeVar Burton was in it until well after Next Generation started. And I wound up waiting for years to go back and see it. And I think that it does hold up over time. There is a reason that it's still referred to with such, you know, reverence and respect. The simple fact that it's such, you know, it's a TV season now. You know, it's a mini series, but it's basically what is regarded as a season now. And they pulled off something that is still a cultural touchstone. So, yeah, I mean, I totally get it. It's enjoyable. It's well written. It's well put together. And it has an emotional impact. It's everything you want from a piece of filmed entertainment to happen.
What about you, Max? Were you familiar with the show prior to this?
Prior to this?
I mean, had you seen it prior to this?
In context, it makes sense. I went to public school, and in public school, they look for ways of getting the job done really fast and easy. So in order to skip past a lot of historical backstory, my history teacher decided to just play a big chunk of Roots and occasionally pause it and go, this isn't exactly how it happened.
Yeah.
They pretty much just walked to villages and were like, we want to buy some people. And the guys there were like, we'll totally give you some people if you give us some guns. Mm-hmm. And the deal was done. So, like, that was the context in which I saw LeVar Burton as Kunta Kinte when I was very young. And for a good chunk of time, that was, like, my entire exposure to Roots was LeVar Burton's section of the series. Essentially, the very early part of Roots that deals directly with slavery and the slave trade. Probably because everything after that is really, really slow and is more of a kind of family drama than anything else. And that's not quite as exciting and controversial and worth talking about in a history class. So that was how I knew LeVar Burton before Star Trek. And, of course, that's actually not a huge chunk of time. It was probably less than a year before Star Trek started up. So I actually knew, to me, LeVar Burton was that guy in Roots who's now on Star Trek. And to me, that was like a get.
Yeah.
And it took me a very long time. Like, not until, like, the show was, like, ending and I was in high school and when I was like, oh, my God, wait, that was like a... That was like 15 years or something, right? That's a huge chunk of time. What? He looks exactly the same.
Yeah, it is weird that is kind of like he was the big star on Next Generation basically because of Roots.
Yeah.
You know, and at the time when he was on Roots, he was like the only person on it who wasn't a star, but that totally made him a star. And the other thing that he was really known for prior to Star Trek was Reading Rainbow, which we'll talk about next week. For me, I had always been aware of Roots, you know, even back before I had started watching Next Generation. And I was aware that Burton was from Roots as well as Reading Rainbow. Basically because I read about it, you know, I think probably in the Next Generation Companion. But I had never seen the show. I had never watched it in school or anything like that. But it was one of those things where I was always like, I know that I need to watch this, but I don't really want to watch this. You know, in the same way that I didn't really want to watch Schindler's List and I didn't really want to watch, you know, any of those types of really, really heavy dramas. And I'm kind of glad that this came up because it gave me a chance to watch it. And, you know, full disclosure, I've still only seen the first 4 hours because those are the ones with LeVar Burton in them. But I am going to finish it up because it's really good.
It is good.
I definitely will. I was shocked by how much they were actually able to do on network television. That was sort of another thing which kind of put me off from it initially was, you know, I've seen Amistad and I've seen 12 Years a Slave and everything like that. And it's like stuff that you can do on the movie screen, especially when you have directors like Steven Spielberg involved, I imagine are going to be a bit more sound than something that was on ABC in 1977. But I was actually shocked by how much they did do here. There's still a little bit of that sort of TV-ness going on. I mean, Ed Asner, as good as he is in this thing, you know, it's a little over the top, you know,
yeah,
a little 70s TV-ish for my taste. But, you know, what can you do? The overwhelming majority of it works really well. And I think kind of like what they were saying on that Writers Guild thing is more than it working dramatically, it really seems to me that it works as sort of, you know, a portrait of the African-American experience from enslavement through liberation, you know, that 100 years. And that to me is sort of more significant than whether or not it works dramatically as a story. And, you know, just kind of like reading about it and hearing about how it sort of became like the thing that everyone in the country was talking about and everything like that. I mean, that's really significant. So,
well, I mean, I think there's more to that. I mean, like, there's the deeper significance of that is that without the conversation, Roots isn't particularly watchable.
Maybe
it's very slow, and without like without the frame of history and the conversation about its presence and what it is about, it really is kind of plodding. Like, it's just kind of miserable for at least the first half.
Mm. I don't agree with that. I just flat out don't agree with that. I remember when I did get around to seeing it, you know, years ago, and started watching it. I find it to be very compelling. I don't find it really to be plot. Yeah, does it take its time? Yeah, they knew they had time to build things, and I think that, you know, it's from a different era of television, for sure. And do they take their time? Yes, but I think the entire thing is compelling. I don't find it to be plotting in any way.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely find it to be more compelling than I imagined it would be. But at the same time, I can see how there are elements of it which might drag a bit, you know. But I think I kind of fall in the middle between the two of you.
Well, it's not really like a criticism. It's more like a reflection on the watchability of things. Like, some things don't really work when you remove them from their historical context.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've referenced it on a number of occasions, but if Citizen Kane came out today, it wouldn't really be all that noteworthy. It's sort of about where it comes and what it means at the moment. And part of the humorous thing about, like, when I first discovered that there was controversy about Alex Haley's history,
yeah,
I remember being surprised that anyone cared.
Yeah.
Oh, he depicted some of the stuff in Africa wrong. It's like, well, he didn't know.
Yeah.
And he didn't actually trace his family lineage back to the... And, like, who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares about his family lineage? Why would that even matter? Well, the idea that he said that I actually traced my lineage back to this guy and this is an actual recounting of facts, that just seems weird. Why bother? Like, it's a story about a thing that happened, not this particular one unique thing and the exact representation of it. If you're telling a story that happened to one person, then, you know, you could say, but just happened to that one person. Like, this is a story about a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
And if you take it out of that context, it kind of actually seems less important.
Well, the thing is, it's an odd, to me, that's an odd criticism for anybody to level, really, because, I mean, I don't know if anybody is still saying, because in the post Oliver Stone era, like, does it really matter at all? I mean, the guy.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't even understand why he would even bother pretending that he actually did this. Like, he did the research and trace his lineage back to this guy. I don't know why he would even bother trying that, because it's not worth it. It doesn't make it better.
Well, everyone's got to have a hook. I can see why you would do that from a marketing standpoint, you know. It's like, hey, look at this. I did this thing, and wow, that's even more impressive. I got to check that out.
It just seems like if you're making something that's going to be controversial and you give people ammunition to tear it apart, it's just a dumb thing to do.
That was probably his mistake. But, like, I agree with you that it doesn't really matter, and I see what you're saying about how it might even be more effective if you're telling everyone's story instead of just your own. But I think the controversy mainly came in the fact that he was like, I did this thing. I did this amazing thing. Look at this thing that I did. And it's like, well...
And the plagiarism stuff is just unacceptable.
Right.
And that's the stuff that is just like, no, that's not just bad. That's actually wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. For those people who don't know, he did settle out of court, you know, and admit to plagiarizing another book when writing this one, so...
It's still a good TV show, though.
It is.
Doesn't take away from it at all.
Right. So, what about LeVar Burton in this thing? Max, what did you think about his performance as Kunta Kinte?
Well, it's really hard to separate from like my entire history of understanding this portion of American history. Mm-hmm. I mean, to a great extent, like when I see, you know, a depiction of slaves, part of my brain is sort of like accessing that childhood memory of seeing LeVar Burton playing this character. Like, no matter how long I go, like when I watched Django Unchained, I was like, oh, this is a lot rougher than Roots.
Yeah.
And I thought Roots was pretty rough. And like, I was still sort of like somewhere behind like the characters, I was thinking like, I wonder if there was an inspiration. I wonder if Roots was an inspiration here. I bet Quentin Tarantino has seen Roots.
Yeah.
But I don't see an active inspiration. I don't see the connective thread. Like, it was still there. So, like, it left an impression that was much more significant than a lot of other movies I was shown in school for historical value. Largely because LeVar Burton made this character whose life story bore no resemblance to my own somehow believable and relatable. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly what he's doing to make that happen. I don't know exactly what acting chops are at play when he isn't saying anything. But when he is not saying anything and he is just, you know, on screen with a facial expression that I couldn't name, I can see that he's thinking. I can see his thought process and his consciousness, and it seems to be the consciousness of the character. And that is an impressive thing to do, especially when he was like, what, like 18 or something?
Yeah, probably like 18, 19 years old, yeah.
It's a very impressive performance. It's so impressive that it's actually kind of hard to imagine that he would get an award for it, because when it's that impressive, people don't see it. If you can't name it, it's really hard to talk about how good it is. So
yeah.
I'm not surprised that he didn't get it.
Yeah.
It's just sort of how it goes.
What about you, John? What did you think about his performance?
Well, I don't know that I can really add anything to that, but I might just offer a theory that what makes his performance work is his youth and is his ability to convey, you know, through different means, that sort of journey from you. When you first meet him, you completely buy his innocence. And then as he goes through his journey, you buy each stage. And I think that a lot of it does have to do with his ability to express through his eyes, which I think gave a lot of context to me when I saw it, because I'd already started watching him as Geordi. It gives a lot of context to his later work, because it's not just his eyes, because he's still really good as Geordi, and he loses the advantage there. With how he expresses things. But I think that in the context of this specific character, he uses his facial expressions to great effect to convey all of those stages and make it believable. And I think if he doesn't sell you in that first meeting, the rest of it doesn't work. So I think it all hinges on that very first meeting of Kunta Kinte as a character.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that he's really good as well. You know, it's kind of crazy that he's really the heart of, well, the first 4 hours of the show, and I think by kind of extension, the show on the whole. And, you know, for a 19-year-old kid who's, this is his first time that he's ever, I mean, he was in like a short film, and that was it. So, I mean, it says, like, and introducing LeVar Burton as Kunta Kinte. You know, for a 19-year-old who is, you know, a first-time actor, and he's stacked up against, like, a lot of the greatest actors of that time period. I mean, you've got Ed Asner and Louis Gossett Jr. and O.J. Simpson and various other people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like he needs to go up against all of these icons, you know, and he's just a nobody, you know, at that point in time. It's like that has got to be incredibly overwhelming. And for him to be able to, like, stand his own and shine and, you know, really anchor this massive, massive piece, I mean, that's insane. And, you know, we see Louis Gossett Jr.
I think we just call him Lou now.
Do we just call him Lou?
I think as a culture we've agreed that we just call him Lou.
Okay, so we see Lou doing his thing in, you know, the second half of these episodes. And, yeah, he's really good, and I don't really know what he does beyond this. But to me, it's like there's a lot more in terms of, like, you know, levels of emotion and performance. I mean, dealing with the fact that you're playing someone who's speaking, like, another language for half the thing, and how do you convey that, especially when you're speaking English, and then you have to make the transition over and all this other stuff. I mean, there's a lot more going on in LeVar Burton's performance than there is in Louis Gossett. I'm sorry, Lou's performance.
Lou Gossett Jr. No, Lou. Not you don't just say Lou.
Oh, okay.
You say Lou Gossett Jr.
Okay.
You don't say Louis.
Okay.
Because nobody calls him that, and that sounds weird.
Sorry. There's a lot more than what's going on in Lou Gossett Jr.'s performance. So, yeah, I was really, really impressed by Burton in this show. So any final thoughts on Roots? What about you, John?
I think that people should see it. I think that people dodge it because of that that feeling of obligation to see it, where, you know, this is the thing you should see. Fine, I'll get around to it. And I think that's delayed a lot of people watching it over time. But I think people should see it. I think that it is an important piece of television history and an important piece of drama to witness. So I think it's well worth, you know, the effort to go out and spend 12 hours with it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of experienced that firsthand. I mean, first off, you know, just not wanting to watch it at all for, you know, my entire lifespan, because it does feel like that type of thing that you are forced to watch in school. And then, you know, getting it for this, and I had the DVD sitting there for weeks and weeks, and I'm just like, I need to watch Roots. I want to watch Roots. I want to see this. I hear it's really good. I'll do that later. Let me watch Rebels first. You know what? I'm going to watch some 24 or whatever, you know. And then finally, it wasn't until today where I'm like, I've got to set aside time and actually do this. And then when I watched it, I was like, yeah, this is really compelling. This really does work. And I am going to watch the rest of it, even if I don't have to. Maybe not right away, but I will, because it is definitely worth checking out. What about you, Max? Any final thoughts?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly how I would respond to it now if I was seeing it for the first time as an adult. But I remember as a kid, we didn't watch the entire thing in my class in one day. It was, I don't know exactly how many days, but it wasn't one, it wasn't two, it might have been four. But at the beginning, I thought, oh no, we're going to be watching a TV miniseries about slavery. That sounds really boring, because they didn't even have cars. Very quickly, it became like something that I was looking forward to, because it was like, hey, we're gonna be watching a movie and not doing math. This sounds great. And it wasn't just like sparing me from the tedium of grade school classes. It was like, we're actually watching something that I'm liking. That's a big deal. And every once in a while when we would pause it and talk about history, it was like, oh, I actually care about this history now. Like, if you had just said, like, oh, yeah, back in the 1700s, they started going to Africa and kidnapping people and bringing them here and making them work for no money, I'd have been like, well, that's super long time ago. Who cares? Mm-hmm. In context, it makes sense, and it means something, and it informs the present day. And I'm not sure how I would respond to it if I was seeing it for the first time now. I think that seeing it as a kid really, really helped me, like, you know, get a handle on things really quickly. And I really liked the idea that my history teacher made a point of pointing out all of the inaccuracies. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't matter if it gets some things wrong, it's important.
Yeah.
That was a big deal for me as a kid, that like this thing mattered, imperfect as it was.
Yeah. And I think even though it does get some things wrong, it sort of gets to the heart of what it was supposed to be kind of an experiential thing.
Either way, as a narrative, it's one thing. As a document, it's another thing. It's as a documented narrative of, like, essentially a shared mythology. And it doesn't matter if it actually happened. It didn't happen the same way. But this myth of like being ripped from one world and brought into another one and enslaved, it occurred and it matters. And by creating this character, who is almost certainly not an accurate representation of any individual, mm-hmm. that's a touchstone. That's a mythology that people can understand. And like, it's a tragedy, but without that touchstone, it's really hard to actually recognize the physical impact and the whole concept of roots, the idea that it starts at slavery and goes up basically almost to present day. Like, the idea is, like, it isn't over. It's still going on. That crime, it has witnesses, and those witnesses have consequences, and there are follow-up crimes, and there's all sorts of things, and it all leads up to today. And it's important to recognize that just because it happened literally hundreds of years ago, that we are not still feeling its effects. That is very important. And that's why I would say that even though it does get slow, it absolutely does, it still matters.
Yeah.
And you should probably make it all the way to the end.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Burton's performance, you know, really does help to connect to that story. And I mean, that's a really big part of it.
And his absence is felt. You feel it when he's gone, because you miss him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, you can watch Next Gen, so it's all right.
There you go. All right. Well, before we go, we have just a couple of other things that we want to touch on. First off, Joseph Sargent passed away last week. He is the director of the Corbomite Maneuver, which was a great episode of the original series. I believe, am I right in thinking that it's the first non-pilot produced?
First non-pilot?
I believe so.
I have referred to it as Pilot 3.
Okay, all right.
Because it also kind of works as a pilot.
Okay. I can never remember the exact order. I know that, I think that was the one that they wanted to air first. And if you look at it, it really does kind of make the most sense as a first episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But regardless, he directed that, and it is a great episode, if you ask me. And he also directed a ton of other stuff. In TV, he won 4 Emmys over the course of his career for things. Kojak, Love Is Never Silent, Caroline, and Miss Rose White. He was also nominated for another 5 Emmys.
Kojak, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know those other ones.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I think they're like miniseries and TV movies and stuff. He also won 3 DGA awards, which is very significant, and he was nominated for another 5. And in the feature film department, he directed a number of movies as well, including The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 and Jaws the Revenge.
Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, huh?
Yeah.
One of those was a decent movie.
Yeah. But for Jaws the Revenge, he also did win 2 awards. He won 2 Razzies.
He has been to the peaks and the valleys, and yes. So we say Godspeed.
Yeah, I've never seen Jaws the Revenge or the original Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, but I hear that Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 is good.
It is. So. Do not watch the remake.
Okay. The remake wasn't terrible, but didn't work for me. So
I haven't seen it.
You're not missing much.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I didn't think that I was.
So, RIP, Joseph Sargent. Finally, just following up on what's been going on with the new Star Trek movie in relation to Star Trek creators, there's a story which was picked up on December 24th. Roberto Orsi, he's been going on to the Trek movie forums, or message boards or whatever, and sort of posting little cryptic tidbits here and there. And he posted something in a thread where he said, "I'm producing nothing more or less." And all of the online bloggers took that to mean he's not writing the movie anymore.
Meaning they read into something that didn't mean anything.
Right. Yeah. Or maybe they did. I don't know.
Okay, but, so they took a comment and they went crazy, extruding all sorts of significance to it.
Yes. I know.
And we're going to now comment on the significance of the things that they assumed.
Well, no, we're just going to follow up in places that they haven't. You know, they took that to mean he's not writing the movie anymore, which may or may not be true. But 2 days later, he said a number of things about a number of topics related to the new movie. In regards to whether or not there's a chance of this thing being good, he said, "Yes, there is much hope. Though our first draft was not the right fit for some, I still believe our second story is something we love and stand behind. Let's see if it sticks." So he's enthusiastic about a new story, but it also does confirm that the old story is getting jettisoned and there is a new story in its place, not just a redraft of the old story. Then, in regards to the new director, Justin Lin, he said, "We had a great time together on the pilot for Scorpion," which is the show that they work on together. It's on CBS, by the way. "He made it look twice as costly as it was. He is a pro and a gentleman. Trek is lucky to have him." So there's that. It's good news.
That is
I'm sure that's completely.
I'm excited.
Earnest, straight from the heart.
I believe it.
No filtering whatsoever.
I believe it. In regards to who is writing the second story, he said P and M and me. Of course, referring to Payne and McKay and him. So that is the thing that no one is writing about, where I'm like, what? I mean, he just said literally just right there that he's still writing the movie.
He said he's writing the story.
Or Patrick and Michael.
That's true. He's writing the story. Yeah.
He might not have a hand in the actual screenplay this time. He might actually just get a story credit, and then those two are going to write a cogent screenplay based on it.
That could be.
Which I know is quibbling, but, you know.
But I mean, that is a good distinction to
make.
Or
it's just sponsored by the letters P and M.
I guess that's a possibility, too. But I'm
so
going
they go
to take
back
it
in time to Sesame Street's creation and create an alternate Sesame Street timeline this time.
Yep.
Oh, like that's so implausible now.
But I'm going to take it to mean that he is at least writing the story along with J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay.
Sure, let's extrapolate lots of significance from it.
and that makes me
How
happy.
Far can we stretch these comments made?
What I like is his comments about Lin, though, are good. I mean, it's nice to hear. It sounds like legitimate, no sour grapes. It sounds like, on some level, he is not holding any sort of grudge about, you know, being booted from the director's chair or stepping down from the director's chair, that there might be an actual honest bone in his body where he says, you know, he's subtextually saying, you know, this was something I couldn't handle and couldn't bring to the screen, and so I'm glad Justin Lin's got it, if anybody. Yeah, you know, maybe that is reading too much into it, but at the same time, that's what I prefer to read into it.
Yeah, and that's fine. And
what if he just has a heart condition and could have got a completion bond?
I mean, that could be true.
There are all sorts of things that could be at play here. There is no reason to assume that any of the PR in this is somehow
there is
to talk about.
There is one thing which a lot of people haven't picked up on because he said it in Spanish, but someone on Twitter
asked... That's a good way to hide things. Say it in a different language.
Someone on Twitter asked him, like, why did you leave? And he responded in Spanish, creative differences. So I know that's the reason why everyone leaves every project in Hollywood, yeah. But, you know,
I'm curious if it means, because they were trumpeting so much that they were going to do a quote-unquote five-year mission retelling, if this means that the studio said no to that. Like, that's the difference here, is they were like, we're not going to do that. We're not retreading. Let's do something different and original.
And that could be... There's another thing which was on Twitter.
I should point out that I put the actual Spanish content through Google Translate, and it came back scheduling conflicts.
Okay.
I don't know what that means. Maybe it's Google doing it. I don't know. Somebody's pulling strings.
He had a birthday party halfway through, and it created a problem.
There was a very interesting exchange which I came across on Twitter between Peter Scaretta, the guy who runs Slash Film, and some other guy. And he said, the funny thing about all the Trekkies bashing Orsi's departure from Trek 3 is that he was gearing to make the most TOS-like Trek movie. And then someone said, if you bought that bit of marketing, you are far too gullible. And Peter responded, not marketing. I actually know a bit about this one. And the other guy, Kenny, said, frankly, his skills of writing anything coherent, I doubt, based on everything his name has been on thus far. And
Peter, I feel the same way about the person who wrote that comment, based on the grammar of that comment.
Well, you only have 140 characters. And Peter said, it's hard to judge purely off of big blockbusters. Wow. Lots of chefs in the kitchen, and you'd be surprised. And then Kenny, I'm getting to the good part here, okay? Bear with me. Kenny said, but while I'm still hesitant to buy into the Lin-led Trek, I doubt things under Orsi would have been any more Trek-like. And Peter said, you are wrong from what I've heard. And Kenny said, and others of your caliber, which I do respect, have heard the opposite. Agree to disagree. And then Peter said, is the part that I find to be interesting.
I'm still with you, Max. I mean, I'm still with you, Max. Sorry.
Freudian slip
right there. Sorry about that.
Peter said, believe me, I know who you're talking about, and he doesn't know what he's talking about on this one. He's way off. That, to me, suggests that they're talking about Devin Faraci and all this stuff about making it more like Guardians of the Galaxy, and everything is not true according to what the Slash Film guy is saying.
No, they're actually talking about me and all the stuff that I've been saying about the Sesame Street crossover.
Okay, all right. That could be, too. That could be too. The only other little thing that he said recently is that, yes, he is still producing, and not just in name only. He says he's right in the middle of it, trying not to let us down. So hopefully he won't. I don't know. We will continue to follow this story.
I don't know. Based on the history so far, I don't imagine they could do anything that would let you down.
It's quite possible, you know. It's quite possible.
It's very possible. You know what? I'll be the one to step in and say, so far as I'm concerned, they got nowhere to go but up, and so I'm really hoping for something here.
All right. Yeah. All right.
At this point, like, they could say, yeah, why not Star Wars crossover? I'd be on board.
I still like.
Let's be honest here. I would be more than on board.
Okay, I'd be okay with that too. You know. Hey, why not?
I would essentially say, fine, both franchises are dead. Let's just sew them together and see what happens.
Let's finally answer the question as to whether the Enterprise could take on a Star Destroyer. We all want to see it.
SWVST?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep, those letters in that sequence. Totally agree.
Anyway, so that's that. Well, it's been fun talking about Roots today. I guess you could say it was fun. The copy says it was fun. I don't know if it's necessarily fun. But that's just one of the things we're talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. Standard Orbit.
And so I was biased against it. Even when I started buying the two-disc collector's edition DVDs, I avoided buying any of the even-numbered movies.
Odd-numbered movies.
Earl Grey.
Like they stated in the end of the movie, you know, they thought he'd outlive all of them. And I'm like, yeah, that's what should have happened. We should have seen Data, like, in the, you know, 26th century, like, Data 5.0, whatever we call him.
To the journey! You don't know if she's going to stab him or smooch him.
She's going to smooch him, of course. After dessert.
After dessert.
We all know what dessert means.
Warp 5.
Along with technology and along with trying to study the origins of a lot of different things that we've come to know in the original series and beyond, it's hard to try and deconstruct it without insulting what has come in all of the things that we know of being Vulcan mind meld.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
And my thought was, in the next scene, Crusher should have the body of the dead Klingon sitting on the back of her toilet holding a candle. You know, what she would only get to do after Lieutenant Yara's gotten to hold the dead Klingon up to her ear to see if she can hear the ocean.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Everything you would imagine would be in an opening title sequence for this show is in there. I think the shot that really does it for me, the shot that really pulls everything together, is when he dunks the basketball.
Melodic Treks.
So we do know an awful lot of people get associated with Vic Fontaine. He name drops to the nth degree about all the famous people that he hangs around with. One of whom is Frank Sinatra.
Axanar, the official podcast.
When there's a possibility for something to be misunderstood or not clearly explained, it can potentially open up a big hole for a show, because people can end up going down a path that was actually not what somebody wanted to be done.
The 602 Club.
What are those Bond movies that you go back to time and time again because they just do it better?
First of all, Matthew, nobody does it better.
That's true.
It makes me feel sad for the rest.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows to get in on the daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory for Xbox and Zune, or you can stream them from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring commentary, Trek Stars, to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source of audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week, from classics to current bestsellers, and even some of the most famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive, Federation, and Spock's World. Audible has something for everyone. John, what do you have for us this week?
This week it's Roots, the Saga of an American Family. Written, of course, by Alex Haley and narrated by Avery Brooks.
Yeah.
So appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It begins with a birth in an African village in 1750 and ends 2 centuries later at a funeral in Arkansas. And in that time span, an unforgettable cast of men, women, and children come to life, many of them based on the people from Alex Haley's own family tree.
And you can get this book for free since you listen to Trek FM. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've yet to read and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek FM. And lastly, there's one more way that you can help us keep Commentary Trek Stars coming to you each week, and that's by becoming a patron of the network on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can donate various amounts on a monthly basis. Anything from a couple dollars to a couple dozen dollars, and you can get various rewards at various levels.
Gold press dollars.
And yeah, we would greatly appreciate whatever you can help us out with.
To the patrons.
to the patrons.
Oh, that's a good name for the bonus content.
There we go. All right, we'll have to suggest that. All right, well, that's about it for LeVar Burton's work on Roots. John, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me crawling around Twitter at Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE. And on a weekly show called Words with Nerds that drops Thursday on the usual network suspect, blah, blah, blah.
And you can find Max and myself on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where we do Commentary Track Stars Off Topic with our friend Brandon. You can also find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. You can email all of us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. And you can also find me right here on Trek FM doing Standard Orbit with Drew. So yeah, that's it for Roots. Next week we will be back for the third part in our series on LeVar Burton's Emmy-nominated work, or Emmy-winning work in this case, where we're going to look at his work on Reading Rainbow.